Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Science and the Bible, Context, Text, and Meaning, presented by Levon Batalden. Let's listen in.
He insists he's my TA, so any handouts and whatever are his technological skill, and he'll be doing some discussion later. But when I'm not here at Holden, I am a professor at a small liberal arts college in New Hampshire, and I'm a botanist by training, but I teach a variety of biologically related courses, anatomy and physiology, microbiology, ecology, kind of whatever they happen to need at the moment. But I've had the opportunity during the last 11 years I've been at this particular college to be fairly active in the liberal education aspect of the college. And for a while I taught history and method of science, helping students see that you can look at the world from many many points of view. And in the last 4 years, when we redid our liberal education program, we started having pathways. And faculty were invited to follow sort of their curiosity and interest and develop a pathway that students would take a semester at the beginning of their freshman year, and again with the same group of about 20 students at the second semester of their sophomore year. And so I chose to do something on science and religion. And what I discovered in that period of time is that, and the name of the pathway was Science and Religion, Strangers, Partners, or Foes. And the initial reaction when we say science and religion is always foe, that they're, you know, incompatible. And as a human being who is a scientist and a practicing Christian, that does not fit with my worldview. In fact, when I was interviewed for the job, one person looked at my resume and saw that I was in college, a biology major, a chemistry and religion minor, said to me, "How could you do that?" So, but I haven't really found it to be that much of a problem. So what I discovered in this pathway is that the conflict comes largely with the idea with Christians, not necessarily so much other religions, and Christians who look at the Bible from a very literal perspective, and then they become rather incompatible. And so that made me start to think a little more about, in more specific ways, about how we might alleviate that problem. I'm just curious, when you hear science in the Bible, what comes to mind for you?
Conflict,
yeah.
Schools, debates in the schools.
Yeah. Big time lately in Kansas, Florida, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
Differences between stories and observations.
Okay, differences between stories and observations. All
right. My immediate assumption or gut reaction is this could be a very fundamentalist interpretation of trying to explain science with sort of this seven-day creation story that immediately when people talk about science and the Bible, that's what comes to mind.
Intelligent design,
yep. And I think sometime in the course of this week we will certainly talk about that in fairly specific ways. I thought I should give you a little idea of what I'm talking about when I talk about science. And the way we think about science today, I think, is different from looking at science in the timeline of the Bible. My global definition of science is the search to understand how the world works, how the natural world works. And I think that's a very old desire, to understand how the world around you works. I think curiosity is a basic human characteristic, that you want to know how the world around you works. And today when we say science, we usually think of a method of figuring out how the world works. Things that you come up with some explanation how something works, and then you figure out how you can test that. You collect a lot of data, you interpret it, and come up with some understanding of how things work. And if we use that definition of science, it's pretty hard to go back and look at science in the time of the Bible. But what I'm choosing to do is define it as how you understand how the world works. And look at times when the people of the Bible lived, when they wrote things down, and what the understanding of those particular time frames might be. And today is going to be basically introduction to the idea and looking at time frames in the Bible. Tomorrow we'll look at about 1000 BC. The next day we'll look at Babylonia, about 600 BC, and then look at the Greco-Roman world, which is a fairly long period of time, but it's the certainly the world in which Jesus lived, was the Greco-Roman world. And then the last day is going to be pretty open-ended. So does this make any difference to you when you read the Bible? And this is only one way of looking at the Bible, certainly not the only way at all. But it's a journey that I've been taking, and I invite you to come on this journey with me and see if it's of any help to you. And ideas that you that come to you as we're doing this journey together. On your handout, you have a couple quotes on the page, and each day we'll look at a couple quotes. And my purpose in the quotes is to put us into a context of the tradition of our church, that we aren't doing anything that's all that new. Christer Sandahl was the dean of Harvard Seminary for a number of years. He's a Swedish bishop, now quite an elderly man, still a member of University Lutheran in Cambridge. And he said, there are two separate questions to be asked in all historical inquiry, especially in biblical studies. What did the text mean, and what does it mean? And so that's what we're going to be doing this week. And certainly, we're not going to answer those questions in any definitive or final way, but it is a question that we need to always ask, and humbly ask those questions, because we're always seeking answers and asking questions. And Jaroslav Pelikan is a, I think, emeritus faculty at Yale, is that correct, Yale Divinity School? And he recently wrote a book, Whose Bible Is It Anyway? And there's another, someone else has written a book with the same title. But in the foreword, he quotes the someone who was representing the Jewish Theological Seminary when they gave him an honorary degree, that you have taught us all that great religious traditions continuously renew themselves through the ages, generating ever-changing interpretations of the ever-constant sacred text of scriptures. So it's a constant learning and experiencing the scriptures, and if we don't want to leave the scriptures in some way long ago time and not making it meaningful to us, that we lose something wonderful. So that's the how I see the week developing, and I welcome you into this experience, exercise, journey. The theme today is context. And I see what we're doing is trying to put various scriptures of the Bible into some kind of context. And there are many different kinds of context, but the one that I'm using this week is a sort of scientific worldview context. And in the Bible study this morning, the context was much more seeing the Bible from the perspective of the marginalized people. Another context in which to look at the Bible. There's not only one. So, but the context that you use makes a huge difference. When we were starting to talk about this, Paul remembered when our older daughter was at our cabin as a teenager and was windsurfing. And she got into kind of a bay that we couldn't see her. But, and I don't remember if it was too windy or not windy enough, but anyway, she got stuck in the bay. And other people saw her and called her from shore, "Are you a Christian?" She said afterwards, I was thinking, is it a good thing to be a Christian or not a good thing to be a Christian? If I'm a Christian, do you think they could just let me die because everything's taken care of? Or if I'm not a Christian, am I not worth saving? So to know the context in which the question is asked sometimes can be fairly helpful. And at this point, I don't remember what she said she was. And I'm sure all of you have stories about either understanding or misunderstanding the context of something and not quite knowing what you ought to do. But anyway, so that's what this is all about. And when we look at the Bible and the times of its writing, oral tradition becomes extremely important because a lot of these things, stories were told long before they were ever written down. And we hear about oral tradition in many different settings. All people without written language have oral traditions that they pass on. And that oral tradition can be passed on faithfully. People, and we play a telephone game kind of thing where you think that oral tradition is not very accurate or predictable, but traditions can be passed on quite accurately over time. But one example of that's the timing and everything is not all that different from the Bible is the Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey. Whether or not even Homer wrote them is unclear, whether it was just a series of stories that were remembered and written down. But the stories that are told in the Iliad and the Odyssey take place long before Homer's time. But it's this beautiful record of the Greek mythology and the journeys of Odysseus. So it isn't just in biblical tradition where we have long oral tradition that's then at some point written down and shared. One possible beauty of oral tradition is you can tweak the stories a little as you tell them, so that if you change a little bit with the context that you're in when you tell the story, so that although the main theme may stay the same, you can tweak it a little bit in oral tradition to make it more meaningful to the time in which you live. But writing things down does capture the time in which it was written down in a way that the oral tradition does not. And you can then compare it with other traditions, and so there's a wonderful thing about writing things down as well. But it seems that what we're attempting to do is re-look at stories in the context in which they were told, written, and that sort of thing. And just as a little aside, even when things are written down, they are copied time after many, many times. And there are certain errors that are made in copying, but when you, when the Dead Sea Scrolls and things were found, the Qumran writings and things, there's an amazing similarity, closeness to the ability to copy of those traditions over time. So I think we shouldn't assume that because things were told or written a long time ago, they're not of any, that they're not accurate or valuable. There are lots of kinds of contexts, and one is geographic, and I think here we're really conscious of geography in this beautiful setting, and the world seems to move, to me at least, moves a little slower, it's a little more relaxed, and I'm much more aware of the amazing heights of mountains here. New Hampshire has mountains, supposedly, but they're kind of like hills, yeah. They're much more like hills.
They've seen more years.
They've seen more years, yeah. They've been wearing down a little bit longer. But geographic context, I think, is important when we look at the Bible. And so let's take a little look at, I wasn't sure if we would have what the technology would be here. So there's a little map, handout map. But when we're talking about the world of the Bible, at least certainly Old Testament, this doesn't take into account Paul and his journeys and that sort of thing. But if you, I've got a magic pointer. We have to hold it down. Over here you have Samaria, Babylonia, in this area, Assyria up here. So that the earliest parts of the Bible, we talk about Abraham coming from Ur, right over here. Then we have periods of time from Egypt, and then over here in Palestine. But if you look at this area over here in Samaria, or Babylonia, you've got the Tigris and the Euphrates River here. So you've got this lush water supply. You go over to Egypt and you've got the Nile. So these early cultures were built around water. But then you get up over here into Palestine, and you don't have so much water. You've got the Jordan River, but you've got a lot of desert. So when people are telling their stories from around rivers, they're going to have a different view of water than if you're talking about stories written in the desert. So just the context of geography might be important when you're looking at some of these stories. And this is just a little bit of a side here, but this is Palestine at the time of the kingdom of David and Solomon. And you know, when we read in the Bible, we've got this huge kingdom here, but when you put that in the, wrong direction, in the context of this map, you know, it's really just this little bit right over here. They were a little bit two-horse kingdom. You know, we're not talking about the Roman Empire when we're talking about David and Solomon. So that if you don't find a whole lot of other information in other people's histories about this kingdom, it's maybe not so surprising. It wasn't a huge, huge kingdom. So, but it's just to give you a little geographic context here. Questions or comments about what we're talking about so far? Then another kind of context is time. Time frame. And this is just a little handout that Paul and I developed that is based on a lot of other people's work. You know, we are not archaeologists, so or historians, but we are people who have been interested in this for quite some time. So it's based on a number of sources and commentaries. And somewhere around 2000, 1500 BCE, this is BCE here, you've got the stories of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, those the patriarchs of the Israelites who lived around that time. Then Moses and the Exodus, about 1300, probably, something around that time. So that what we're reading in the Bible study this morning is from that time period. And then you have the Judges for a couple hundred years, King Saul and David and Solomon around 1000 to 900 in that time. And then you have the separation of the kingdom to the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And in 722, the northern kingdom falls to Assyria, that bigger power from the north. And we kind of lose track of those folks. They're kind of out of the biblical story. And in 587, the southern kingdom is exiled to Babylonia. And we'll see that a lot of the biblical writings come from this time when they're in exile. And some of the Jews stay in Palestine. They don't all get exiled. And then some return when the around 539. And just to sort of put into perspective some of the other historical characters here, we've got Hippocrates lived 460 and 377. Then Plato, Aristotle, these folks that get to be fairly important in the Greco-Roman world and the New Testament time. And then 4 BC to 30 BC is when Jesus lived. Paul's converted about 40. Then Jerusalem gets destroyed in 70, in the Common Era. And the Old Testament canon gets established around 100 in the year 100 in the Common Era. And the Protestant canon and the Jewish or Hebrew canons is pretty much the same. Order's a little different, but the same books are in there. The Apocrypha is part of the Roman canon. Then Origen lives, one of the early church fathers that we'll talk about a little bit another day, lived about around 200, Augustine 300, 400 time. And the New Testament canon became pretty much solidified about 400 Common Era. But it wasn't actually officially adopted until 1540. So the canon of the New Testament is really officially fairly late, although it didn't change much after this time. There were a number of councils. Luther lived in this period of time. And the inerrancy of the Bible, we think that this might, others might disagree with this, but comes out of a group of Princeton theologians in the late 19th century that declared that the Bible was inerrant. You don't find that theme earlier. Literal word of the Bible was inerrant. So much of the conflict that we have today is kind of new.
Could you tell people about CE and BCE?
Oh, yes.
For some people, that's a new designation.
Okay, BCE is before Common Era. So before 100, before zero. I don't know if anybody calls it here zero, but anyway, before that time. But we used to say just before Christ, before Common Era is a word commonly used now. And Common Era is AD, same time. Thanks for pointing that out. And then on the other side of your, I guess it's on the same side of your sheet. Paul and I went through and looked at a number of sources again and came up with some currently, I think, generally accepted times for the setting of the Bible and then when it was actually written down. And if you look at Genesis, you've got some there that's prehistory. And prehistory meaning before things were written down. And there, from what we know, at least in the Western world, and we're kind of ignoring Asia, and we're ignoring the Americas, where there certainly were cultures and things at the same time, but our tradition basically comes out of this Western world. Writing is probably in about 3500 BCE in Sumeria, the first writing. So we're not going to have written things from much earlier than that. So we've got Genesis, there's the prehistory, but then from about 2000 to 1200 is where those stories take place. And there, things that were written down as early as about 1000, and continually up until about 600. Exodus, that's about Moses and Exodus, about 1300, but it was written between 700 and 500. So it's a young woman yesterday said that it was so eye-opening to her when she was in seminary, and it was actually clearly said, you know, the Bible is written in post-Easter, so everything's written in the perspective that Easter occurred. It isn't like somebody kept a diary.
In the New Testament.
In the New Testament.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the New Testament. So these things were written looking back on many of these, and so slightly different context than the actual setting. So many of these books took place much before they were actually written down. And as you move up, and in Psalms and Proverbs and they don't have a setting in the same way that some of these other do. But Psalms and Proverbs have long, long history. Many of Proverbs probably are old Egyptian sayings that were, and Sumerian sayings that were incorporated. So they have a a very long time frame. But this is just kind of when they were probably compiled in the present culture. More of the Old Testament, these settings of probably the 8th century, but things written down in the 6th and 5th. So you see, a lot of things are written down 6th century and later. And there will be no exam here. And I really would hate if you'd memorized this information because it's not that hard and fast. It's a sort of best guess. And there's a lot of disagreement on because the understanding changes. You'll notice Song of Solomon, when it was written, 10,000 or 1,000 or 300, 10th century or 3rd century. Some scholars think Song of Solomon is really, really old, coming out of fertility cult writings. And others say, no, it's really, really quite recent, 3rd century BC. So there's, and people keep learning more things about, and figuring more things out. So it's a constantly interesting adventure. And then in the New Testament, we're not talking about such long periods of time. And as you look here, you can see that the earliest writings are Paul, Mark, the earliest gospel, John, the latest gospel, and Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians is probably one of the oldest extant piece that we still have in the original. These letters to John are also late. Jude is probably really, really old. That's an exaggeration, old in comparison to the writing of the New Testament. So these are just, and Revelation is late as well. So this is just to give you a little bit of a framework from which we were coming when we were talking about these things. Questions, comments?
Who decided what would actually be in the Bible?
There are probably others here that can answer that a little better than I can, but would you like to comment on that?
Well, I think that there were councils of the church that actually brought the church fathers together in an effort to decide that. But there were patterns of use that actually seemed to argue for the inclusion of this book or that book in the Bible. And so, for example, one of the early tussles, or one of the tussles in the New Testament was whether to include the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of John as the as part of the New Testament canon, both written about the same time. But there was a significant concern that the Christians were not able to identify themselves as distinct enough right about the time that the decision seemed to be being made. And the Gospel of John was much more exclusionary than the Gospel of Thomas, which was much more inclusive. And so what you see is, or at least what seems to me to be the case, is that there were rationales that got developed around what the need was or what the perceived requirements were for the life of the church at that particular time. And so these forces came to play. But my guess is that there are others here that would have other things to say about that. But I think that it was an issue that people wrestled with a good bit. And the decisions were not trivial decisions. They were decisions that were the subject of a lot of argument and controversy. And the people who were engaged in making those decisions really didn't treat the writings as this inerrant set of words, but rather these were writings that were intended to convey certain central themes or certain important themes that related to the life of the church, as I best put that together. But I don't know, Chris or others want to add to that?
Well, the age of the documents, the earlier the better, was one criterion. There were certain ones that had titles like Sinaiticus, Sinaiticus, and others, you know more about this, that somehow gained a greater appreciation than some others. So there became the criterion that Paul identified of certain themes, whether it was inclusionary and otherwise. Harmonious with prior scriptures was also a criterion, including scriptures that we may have had available for, that we now call the First Testament.
So
not the Old Testament, by the way. No.
Okay. Yes, there are many terms to use here. Another sort of question on, you know, in determining some of these dates and times and who wrote things and when they were written, there some of the clues is what are there other historical events that are mentioned? You know, are there it's easy to date the time of the exile of the Jews because it's written in several places that this is when Babylonia took over this area and things of that sort. And so that they look for historical events that might date the time that this was written. Or whether does it look like they had already experienced the exile when they were writing this or something of that sort. I was also led to believe that the language itself, the language that's used, and Chronicles is written, they think, late because the Hebrew is very stilted. It doesn't flow the way some of the earlier books did. And Hebrew was not the common language at that point. Aramaic was spoken and Greek was beginning to be spoken. So in the late, before the Common Era time, Hebrew had almost been lost, and so that's why the Hebrew scriptures were translated into Greek, so that the Hebrews themselves could read their own scriptures. So the problem of translation is old, not recent. So, archaeology is also a tool that's used to try and figure some of these things out. And there are a few little goodies that I came across that I thought were interesting. In some relatively recent archaeological discoveries, they found in what was the Canaan, land of Canaan in the Bible, about 300 new villages that date to the 13th and the 12th century, which is the time of the patriarchs in the Bible. And these were not villages that were built on the site of old Canaanite villages, but there were about 300 new villages that came into being at about that time. And so that there was some kind of influx of people. And that the and I have no idea the exact technique that archaeologists use to determine the population of an area, but archaeologists' best guess is that in the 13th century in Canaan, or that area, whatever you want to call it, there were about 12,000 people living. And in the 12th century, there were 55,000 people living there. And in the 11th century, there were 75,000. And that would be too many people to just have been, just the population that was there to have grown that fast. And it was also more people living in these villages than could be accounted for by just nomads settling down, who were already living there. So there seems to have been some influx of people in that land during that period of time when people have been, when Abraham had been coming and people coming from Egypt from the Exodus. So, and the other thing that we have archaeologically are lots of tablets because the cuneiform writing came into being. And you know, if you go down into the pottery shop and if you look at pottery, a lot of it breaks, but it doesn't fall, but it doesn't disintegrate. Once pottery has been formed and fired, it lasts. So when you dig up archaeological things, you find pottery. And pottery is basically what the early writing was done on. It was clay tablets that were
wedged, writing was done, and then it lasted. So there are so many old tablets of writing, and some are just our business documents, and but some are stories and tales. So there are quite a few new tablets. And figurines and pottery, different artifacts. And what archaeologists find in these villages that they dig up, that they can tell Israelite villages from Canaanite villages to some degree by the fact there are no pig bones in Israelite villages, so that they can kind of determine that this was probably an Israelite village. But in those villages, they find a lot of little figurine statues of goddesses and gods and things. So that this ongoing message in the Old Testament is, you know, don't against idolatry and don't have false gods. This wasn't an imaginary problem from what you see archaeologically. That you know, your little household gods were pretty common. So as, that's just a sort of introduction to the idea of context. What kind of world work with the biblical peoples living in? Just as a little exercise to test out some of these things, on the back side of your handout, there are a number of biblical passages. One group comes from Exodus, and the other comes from Deuteronomy. And find one or two other people that you can work with and pick one of those groups. I'll let Paul do this section.
What we're interested in is to see the similarities and differences between the same message that's being talked about in these two different books that were written in two different times. So if you work with one or two people right around you, and take either the letter A or B or C or D or E or F and compare and contrast those two readings and answer for yourself what might have been the context for these two different texts. You have the cheat sheet that we gave you earlier about sort of the time period that Exodus and the time period that Deuteronomy might have represented. They're not too far off. They're about the same kind of period, but it does look like Deuteronomy might have been a little more recent than Exodus, Exodus being a little older. And so you can sort of begin to think about the context that these texts were written for, remembering Stendhal's questions about what did the text mean, and then we try to get at what might it mean today. So take about 10 or 15 minutes to sort of tease out what those two different texts might mean and how they're different and how they're alike.
And keep in mind that Exodus has a lot more oral tradition in it than would some group like to volunteer differences they saw between the two passages?
That was trying to make sense of this choice of passages.
We took the last one being, I think we figured out that both of us are contrarians.
I see, okay.
Work backwards. One of the first things that both of us came up with in the observation of the Exodus, we were trying to decide whether the two sentences in question are really supposed to even be connected. The choicest of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring into the house of the Lord, your God, seems to be quite a philosophy statement. And you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk, to me translates to Jewish dietary law. So that was kind of our first unresolved question and remains somewhat unresolved. The Deuteronomy goes more towards the, I think, the philosophical statement or the kind of being aware of history, where you came from, where you are now, and giving thanks to the Creator that led you there.
So much more detail and history.
And then we cheated a little bit and went back to the Exodus and looked at what happened before and what happened a little bit after.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be a lot more interested in the law, the do's and don'ts of being Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anybody, any other comments? Yes.
We did the last one also. The thing that struck me about the Deuteronomy text was that it was almost like the institution had matured and there was a whole set of details that you now have to follow, as opposed to, like you pointed out, the philosophical initial statement. Now they've grown this into a process. At least that's the impression that I got.
Committee's worked it over.
Right?
The committee's worked it over.
The committee's worked it over.
That's what's on here.
Yeah, that's it. Any other? Yes?
I think that was the same general observation we had. I mean, as others, we started at the end and worked away. We just kind of kept on going and. Yeah, right. The Exodus would be more of these ideals. Like, wouldn't it be nice if this, you know, general statements, like a Bill of Rights or something, and then the Deuteronomy realize, okay, how do we apply all this, these ideals? And when it comes down to it, who are you going to give the first fruits to? What's it going to be in? You know, have this kind of basket.
Okay. Well, a little bit later in Deuteronomy, it says, and these are the strictures and ordinances that you are to observe.
Yeah.
Right.
It's
got to
be done that way.
Right.
Did anybody do E?
Okay. We did. We found a similar progression from the simple or the primary to more expanded. And that is in the Exodus one, it was simply a matter of every seventh year you take care of the land. You let it lie fallow.
And that was the next verse.
And
the verse here was just you plant. For 6 years, you plant your land and gather in what it produces. I mean, that's very straightforward.
And I think it's good to go on to that next verse.
It is, yeah, because then you let the wild animals and others have during that seventh year. In the Deuteronomy text, you get to the people and the forgiving of debts. You know, we got to take care of the people too. But that Exodus one is kind of neat with our theme here. You take care of the soil. And but then it's the people. If you've got a loan out, you forgive the loan in the seventh year. There's a little distinction between the Hebrews and the non-Hebrews.
Israelites.
A little more generous with the Hebrews. And then the conclusion of all of this was be generous with the poor, basically.
Mm-hmm. So those two themes are there continuously.
Mm-hmm. To me, it sounded like they were more concerned about what's happening with the Israelites, and, you know, there are these other people, but your primary duty is within your Israelite community.
Do you think why that might be different from that one in Exodus versus Deuteronomy? Does the time in which it was written give you any clues?
The verse I read was 10, but the one before that in verse 9, it says, do not mistreat a foreigner, for you know how it feels to be a foreigner, because you were foreigners in Egypt. Mm-hmm. So in the, you know, and then by Deuteronomy, they've kind of forgotten about how it felt to be the foreigner. Now they're established.
And this Exodus thing, they're concerned about the land. They're basically farmers. They're agrarian people when the Exodus was written. And Deuteronomy, they're people in exile. They're living in cities. And so they don't have control of the land in the same way. So leaving the land fallow may not be the same as debts that you owe people. But there's still that same thing you need to remember those who, whether it's the land or other people, who are less fortunate. In that seventh year, you need to. Were there other passages that people read that they wanted to? Anything up on the
top shelf?
We did the last one.
Well, we did the middle one.
Oh, good.
Which is, well, D. And Exodus refers to basically not eating mangled flesh in the field, whereas Deuteronomy goes into many, many sentences of explicit dietary instructions about which protein source you should go to. Mm-hmm. What kind of hoof the animal should have, and whether they chew their cud, and whether they slither, and mm-hmm. just goes into painstaking detail about what kinds of things to eat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we wondered if that had something to do with, you know, the food supply, what was available to them, what was considered safe food, what was considered maybe food that was contaminated. Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Exodus, we thought, well, maybe they didn't have a lot of food, so they basically can eat anything that hasn't been mangled by a beast and lying in the hot sun for a week or so. Whereas in Deuteronomy, they probably have a more plentiful food supply, so they can kind of pick and choose what they want to eat.
Yeah.
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 I think there's also a maturation of knowledge, maybe a little bit more knowledge, more categories of stuff. And you know, science is about categories, categorization of things. And so what you see is this accompaniment of more and more precision in the description of what it is that you're to do. And the old idea gets now morphed into a time when there is some more knowledge, there's some more precision in the way it's described. And as we were sort of thinking about this, series, one of the things that was intriguing to us was this idea of from the New Testament where Paul wrote about the importance of women keeping their hair covered. And it turns out that at that time one of the prevailing beliefs was that the hair of women was a genital organ that sucked semen from the male. And so that the prevailing idea was that with that as a part of your genitalia, you would cover your genitalia when you're in public. And so the idea of women keeping their hair covered just had to do with keeping your genitalia covered. And so the issue of sort of the way we carry some of these things and the relationship of those things to the prevailing viewpoints gets to be an important clue about sort of what was going on here, and not in the sometimes literal invitations that we get to interpret what the Bible is actually saying or trying to tell us as we try to understand and decipher it. So as we go forward now, we're going to try to pick up. The reason for going into all this chronology is to try to figure out, well, what was the prevailing scientific thought then? So tomorrow we're going to pick up on this business of, so how did people at that time think scientifically? And then we'll move into these three different time periods on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, taking each day one different time period and some little snapshots of scientific reasoning and thinking as we try to get at that for the conversation. And then crosswalk that to some texts in the Bible and try to figure out, well, now if you were thinking that way, what in the world would this text mean? And what does it mean for us today? And so that's basically the way we'll proceed. Is that fair?
And I guess we didn't really do that last question on these passages we read today. You know, when you read those passages, what does it say for us today? What, you know, it was said in different ways, but is there something that we need to take on that and not just say, well, that's the way they thought back then?
Well, we did B, and we kind of came up with a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. The contrast between B, which is the Exodus, which is do not abuse the disenfranchised or I'll kill you, you smoke, versus redistribute and support the disenfranchised, the resident alien, the widow, the children, the orphans, by leaving a portion of your harvest in the field, leaving some olives on the trees, leaving some grapes on the vines so that they can go in and glean when you're not out in the field and feed themselves, that it went from a basically don't abuse them to help take care of the disenfranchised. And that was sort of a more modern theme, but again, it requires that you have more than basic sustenance, as we have in the current time, to be able to do that. So it was an evolution there.
It isn't that we have lost the poor and disenfranchised.
No, they've been around. It's just
and
the message was that you owe them more than simply not abusing.
Yeah. Any other messages that you?
Well, we did the first one, first we discovered that this Deuteronomy gets a little confusing, and
we need a lawyer.
Well, my wife's a lawyer, and you see the emergence of the need for a lawyer because they get into witnesses, the number of witnesses, so you see the law emerging, and I never would have read it before. My wife would.
Yeah. So some basic themes that got adapted to a different situation, but the same early concern about care for the foreigner, care for the poor, care for those who are less fortunate. We may look at the Israelites wandering around as not being too wealthy or too blessed, but they were still expected to care for those who were less fortunate or alien or different sense of
life. One thing we did, D, the one, don't eat the, pray, the risk, don't eat the roadkill, in essence, and then you get to Deuteronomy, and it says, all this really spelled out way that we're supposed to eat. And I don't really know all the health implications of all those laws in Deuteronomy about the hoofed animals and the non-hoofed animals. Maybe they picked up bacteria if they were hoofed or not. I don't know why they made those rules. But it's sort of in our time then, sort of looking back at, well, maybe the message is, don't eat roadkill because you could get sick from that. Well, what does that mean for us in our food choices today? What would it say? Fast food nation, don't eat McDonald's because it's bad for your body, or, I don't know what it would read, but I think it's at least worth thinking about to make it relevant to our own situation.
Well, don't eat beef from cows that have been fed parts of other cows. The mad cow.
If you feed animals things they're not meant to eat, it's probably not a good idea.
The whole warnings now about a lot of seafood.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is not good.
Mm-hmm.
Because of its environment.
Well, I think Jewish dietary law, wasn't it set up as a very, rudimentary public health service for Jews?
Mm-hmm.
They were a minority of the population to begin with, and if they ate food that was contaminated or poorly stored, particularly shellfish. Even today, if you don't get good oysters, they're going to come back up rather violently. But we have a few medications available today to take care of upset stomachs and a few bacteria outgrowths. They didn't then, and so if you got sick, with the mortality rates being what they were, it could be a lot more serious. So with the do not eat pork edict, is there something wrong with the animal in and of itself, or is there something wrong with the way that the animal is raised, perhaps the way that the animal is killed, the way that the animal is preserved and ingested after that? I think the Jews themselves saw and observed medical conditions that came out of poor hygiene,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of refrigeration, lack of preservative, and since they wanted to protect their people and their population, they came up with these series of laws: don't eat shellfish, don't eat pork, don't eat da 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 da.
Well, they weren't alone. I mean, Pythagoras, about the same time, said, don't eat beans. And what he was really after was fava beans. And it's rumored that he died on the edge of a fava bean field as he was being chased to the edge of the field. Mm. And the reason we think that people of that genetic makeup shouldn't eat fava beans is that there's a peculiar enzyme defect in the red blood cells that actually causes a hemolytic reaction. The red blood cells break up when people of that particular genotype eat fava beans. And so what was interesting, and of course they got black urine and stuff like that, so they knew it. They didn't have any kind of genomic testing, but they basically had the capacity to know that there was a cause and effect relationship. And so for a lot of these things that were got carried along, there was some reason for these things that was established. And this idea of cause and effect we'll see develop in much greater way in scientific thinking as we progress forward. But at this stage, there were these associations that people had. But then that moves into more cause-effect reasoning, the way that we today in science think about things.
And I think it's important to keep in mind that we shouldn't look back at people and think, how could they be so stupid and look at the world this way, but that they had actually figured a lot out. They were good observers and understood a lot. And we shouldn't judge them by what we know today, but by the fact that they had figured out as much as they had. And I think some of these dietary laws are probably good examples of that, that they were good observers, because if you didn't observe, you'd probably die. There was a pretty good incentive to make good observations.
Then that also brings up the question today, okay, since we do have better preservatives, better refrigeration, do we continue to observe dietary law for conservative Jews?
Yeah. So it's a different reason, but if your dietary law is what sets you apart as a special group, then it serves another purpose as well. Well, I was waiting for a bell to ring. I'm sorry I didn't let you folks go. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Have a good rest of the day.